Very recently, my wife has introduced me to a series of historical books written by a former journalist for National Geographic named Candace Millard. And she's written three books at present. Her sort of historical specialty is from the sort of latter half of the 1800s through the earliest years of the 1900s. I've read through two books so far, one about Winston Churchill, his rise to fame through the Boer War, which I will confess I knew nothing about, but Lindsay had heard a radio interview with this gal about this book, and sure enough, the book, it was long, but it was captivating. And then this book is the one I just recently finished. I don't want to present myself as some voracious reader. I wish I read more. But this book has really just, it was an awesome, awesome story about something I had never heard before. It's called River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey. Now, what you, of course, hopefully know about Theodore Roosevelt is he is a former president of the United States. What was interesting about him is that Teddy Roosevelt was always known as a man who loved physical challenges. He loved to overcome anything in his life by attacking it physically, and when life got hard, he would lean on some sort of thing that would tax him physically. He had been told as a very young child, excuse me, that he would never amount to anything in life. He was too sickly, too weak, that illness would certainly overcome him. And so immediately he threw himself into this physical training regimen and wowed and amazed anybody who knew him. He, of course, went on to become a famous war hero and likewise president. After he had been president, he stepped away for 4 years. But in the election of 1912, he decided he was going to run again. He just tried to run as a third-party candidate, finished second, but came in a distant second. And he felt a bit depressed about this. He had hoped that his name, that his, you know, fame, that his ability to captivate an audience would rally the people back to his side, but it didn't. And so he had to figure out what to do. So in the past, he had thrown himself into, you know, safaris in Africa and gone on long hunting journeys, and he had done other things. He was, of course, his hobby was actually naturalism. He loved to be in nature. He was the president who we can kind of thank for our National Park Service. So what he decided to do in 1913 was he was going to go on a journey down an uncharted river in the heart of the Amazon jungle. He had heard about this river, was known as the River of Doubt, that no one had ever been down before. And he said, I want to go down this river. I want to put it on the map. I want to, you know, be part of this journey. And so he teamed up with a group of other folks, and they sure enough went to travel down this river. Well, almost from the second day they were out there, he quickly realized he was in over his head. He was now in his mid-50s. He had grown a little bit lazy in his sort of, you know, years post-presidency. He wasn't in near the physical condition he had been in some 20 years ago. He was a little more tired, a little more flabby. He hadn't done a lot of things to get himself prepped for this journey. And he quickly realized, I'm not at all prepared. But being a prideful man, he wasn't going to let anybody know that. And so he championed on down this river, and the journey very nearly killed him. By the time they were done, after several months traveling up, he was so sick. He had lost over 50 pounds. And he was so sick and so weary, he couldn't even stand. They would have to put him in the barge on this river and just float him along, covered up by the tarp there in the middle to make sure that the you know, sun didn't give him heat stroke. He eventually recovered afterwards, but he would write in his journal that this journey had probably taken at least 10 years off of his life. And it was very prophetic because it ultimately did. Had he have known his limits, had he have been a little more honest about who he was, where he was, what he was physically capable of, he might have been able to avoid this whole unfortunate event. It pays for us to likewise know our limits. A lot of us live with the expectation that if we work hard enough, we dream hard enough, we put forth enough effort, enough time, enough whatever, we can achieve most anything we put our minds to. And sometimes we can, and then sometimes we can't. There's just sometimes things that we have to come to grips with that we just can't do by ourselves. That's a hard thing for us to swallow. The number one sin of the human race will forever and always be pride. And whether it's that we can achieve something without the help of our friends, or whether we can achieve something without the help of Almighty God, pride will always be the first thing that gets in our way. And so there's ways to overcome that. And sometimes it just comes through the lessons we arrive at through life. I want to look at a story this morning from the midpoint of Moses' life. This will be in Exodus chapter 18. I'm going to go ahead and turn your Bibles that direction. It starts on page 58 in the Pew Bible in Exodus chapter 18. We saw last Sunday how Moses has now successfully led the people through their first battle campaign. Last Sunday we saw Moses had to keep his arms up and keep the staff raised, and sure enough he had some friends that came along and helped him do that. The people have gained victory, and now they've continued to travel onward through the wilderness of Sinai. And so in chapter 18, a couple of interesting things happen. We are reintroduced to Moses' father-in-law. This is verses 1 and 2. Now Jethro, the priest of Midian and father-in-law of Moses, heard of everything God had done for Moses and for the people of Israel, and how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Verse 2, after Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her and her two sons. One son was named Gershom, for Moses said, I have become a foreigner in a foreign land. The other was named Eleazar, for he said, my father's God is my helper. He saved me from the sword of Pharaoh. So Jethro has heard all the good news about what's taken place for Israel, how they've been led forth from slavery, how they've traveled onward, how they've crossed the Red Sea, how they've now achieved victory in this very first battle. And any married man in the room knows that your father-in-law likes to check in on you. Your mother-in-law is always concerned about a host of different things, but the thing that the father-in-law is always most concerned about is, are you taking care of my little girl? Are you making sure my girl's provided for? Are you making sure my girl's safe? Are you taking care of my grandkids? And so Jethro has come along to do a little check-in on Moses, see what kind of man he is, see what kind of leader he is. And he's heard all these great things, but he needs to see it for himself. And so sure enough, he sees Moses, he sees Zipporah, he sees the two boys, and he can't be more excited. Picking up at verse 5, Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, together with Moses' sons and wife, came to him in the wilderness where he was encamped near the mountain of God. Jethro had sent word to him, saying, I, your father-in-law Jethro, am coming to you with your wife and your two sons. So Moses went out to meet his father-in-law, bowed down and kissed him. They greeted one another and then went into the tent. Moses told his father-in-law about everything the Lord had done to Pharaoh and the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and about all the hardships they had met along the way and how the Lord had saved him. 9. Jethro was delighted to hear about all the good things the Lord had done for Israel in rescuing them from the hand of the Egyptians. And so he goes on to say this little prayer of thanksgiving. He can't be more excited about who Moses is, what Moses has done, and that his daughter is married to this man. He is elated. Skipping down a little bit, verse 13. The next day, Moses took his seat to serve as judge for the people, and they stood around him from morning until evening. When his father-in-law saw all that Moses was doing for the people, he said, what is this you are doing for the people? Why do you alone sit as judge while all these people stand around you from morning until evening? Moses answered, because the people come to me and seek God's will. Whenever they have a dispute, it is brought to me, and I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and instructions. So apparently, not only is Moses in charge of overseeing this gaggle of 2.5 million people wandering through the wilderness, not only is Moses in charge of basically being their go-between between the people and God, not only is Moses charged with knowing where to go on any given day, not only is Moses supposed to make sure they have food and water and be well provided for, but also Moses sits from morning until evening hearing them bicker about certain things and arbitrating between disputes. She stole my bread, and so Moses has to take care of that. And well, he stole my sheep, and now Moses has to figure out whose sheep is who. And Moses does this from morning until evening, day after day after day. And now Jethro is not as excited. What we need to remember from a bit earlier is that Jethro is identified as a priest in Midian. From where they came from, Jethro was both the priest, he himself is a go-between between the people and God, but he's also a leader. Jethro understands what it is to be in leadership. He understands what it is to have a group of people that look up to him. And he says, basically, Moses, you're doing too much. He says, you got too much responsibility. You don't need to do everything by yourself. As an older man, as a wiser man, he wants to impart this wisdom to Moses. He says in verse 17, what you are doing is not good. You and these people who come to you will only wear yourselves out. The work is too heavy for you. You cannot handle it alone. Listen now to me, and I will give you some advice, and may God be with you. You must be the people's representative before God and bring their disputes to Him. Teach them His decrees and instructions. Show them the way they are to live and how they are to behave. Let's select capable men from all the people, men who fear God, trustworthy men who hate dishonest gain, and appoint them as officials over hundreds, over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. Have them serve as judges for the people at all times, but have them bring every difficult case to you. The simple cases they can decide for themselves. That will make your load lighter because they can share it with you. If you do this, and God so commands, you will be able to stand the strain, and all these people will go home satisfied. And what I appreciate most about Moses is Moses is able to get his pride out of the way. He's able to take the advice from his father-in-law. Sometimes it's hard to take advice from other people, but Moses receives it, and he says, you know what, you're absolutely right. And so he does precisely what Jethro asks him to do. He breaks down, he has different, you know, sort of ranks of judges that handle over small things, and now Moses only has to deal with the big stuff, and the people are much better off for it. They're able to deal with their own things effectively. It's pride that says we can do everything by ourselves. It would have been very easy for Moses to say, but I like sitting on this seat. I like being the only judge. I like being this important. But there comes a time you simply cannot do it. One of the things we need to understand is you got to recognize the warning signs in your life when it comes to overwork and it comes to down to making better choices. All of us are prone to this, but there comes a point you've got to recognize that when you're trying to do too much, it doesn't benefit you, neither does it benefit anybody else. The first thing that happens is stress. Stress that wears us down, stress that makes the medical community thousands and thousands of dollars a year, from hypertension to heart issues to everything else. Stress wears us down. And then our emotions get worn down and we get irritable. And when we get irritable, we start to lash out at other people for no apparent reason whatsoever until it starts to affect different things going on. It's almost unthinkable that, you know, this stress and overwork can do this to us, but it does. There was a pastoral colleague of mine I followed at my first congregation, and they used to tell stories about this guy. And what he would do is he would work himself so hard, he would go like gangbusters for about a month. And then he'd have to take a week off because he was physically ill. And they thought that was a good thing. What I wanted to say to them is, why didn't you tell him to chill out? I likewise had one of my dad's absolute best friends. And this was a man that I looked up to, I revered, because he had the life that I wanted. This man had a life that I desperately wanted to have. He and his family lived in a huge house in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. I mean, massive property, sprawling. It was beautifully landscaped. He didn't cut his own grass. He had people that did all this stuff for him. The house was just decorated with all sorts of manner and makes of ornate things. They were right around the corner from Longwood Gardens. You know, high rent district. And he lived there. They drove nice cars, wore nice clothes. You know, certainly were never concerned about money. And I said, this is the man I want to be. I want to find out what this man has done. He worked hard. He worked really hard to get what he had had. And sure enough, he had possessions, he had cars, he had clothes, he had a bank account that was loaded. But what he didn't have was a happy family life. His job necessitated that he was on the road almost every week, usually overseas. He was in international sales, and one week he'd be in Japan. And one week he's in Africa, and one week he's down in South America, and the other week he's over here. And sure enough, he got the jet set everywhere. But he was distant from his home. He had all that stuff, but it cost him his marriage. We got to recognize when our priorities are a bit out of order. We got to recognize when we need to take a step back and make better choices. Part of that involves finding balance. finding the balance between the things we need to get done and the things that we don't need to get done. All of us have the same number of hours in any given week. We can't manufacture more time. We can't find an eighth day. We can't find a 25th hour in a given day. So we got to take what God has given us and figure out how to employ it best. Part of it comes down to scheduling. One of the things that I cover with couples in premarital counseling is this almost insane thought of sometimes you've got to schedule time with your significant other. It sounds nuts, but sometimes you do. Because otherwise the other things, whether it's work, whether it's kids' activities, whether it's just other stuff we get ourselves involved with, it pulls us away from the things that matter most. Think about Moses. Moses is tasked with leading the people of Israel. He is God's man. He's tasked with all of these different things. But do you recognize what his first and foremost responsibility was? To be a father and a husband. That's what Jethro is driving at. Moses, you got to get that priority first. Sure, you and God, great. You and the people, great. What about your kids? What about your wife? Or you have that in balance somewhere? Because if you're going to sit on this seat and judge all day long, you're not going to be home for dinner. Get your schedule straight. Secondly, learning to say no. Most of us are really good at saying yes. We'll say yes to most anything and everything. Sure, put me on that thing. Send me over here. Let me do this thing. I'll sign up for this. Let me do this. There comes a time, sometimes you just got to say, no. No, I'm not going to do that. No, I'm not going to overextend. I'm going to keep myself where I need to be because there's things that I want to get done. When the things that you have signed up for start to get in the way of the things that really matter, you just got to learn when it is okay to say no. And trusting others. Some of us have an inborn distrust of other people. And perhaps it's been reinforced in us through things like group projects when we were in school. One of the things that I found in college and even in seminary is they love to put us on these group projects. Group of like 6 or 7 people and you're going to knock out this lab project for psychology, or 6 or 7 people and you're going to work on this community service project. You know how that ends up going. There's one person that does all the work, and there's 5 people that sign their names to what the first person did. They cheer them on, they rally them, yeah, you do what you want to do, but they don't do a darn thing to get the project done. Maybe it starts there, but we end up with this great distrust of signing things over to other people. We've got to get better at that. Find some trustworthy other people, they do exist, and let them handle things. Whether it's at work, whether it's at home. At home, being able to, you know, divvy things up goes a long way. If there's one person in the household that is responsible for 95% of the things that take place there, I promise you, he or she is exhausted and could use that extra effort. Again, the thing that I am struck by, much like last week, is Moses, in addition to all of his other character things we can celebrate, Moses is humble. Moses is humble enough to listen. He's humble enough to learn new lessons. He's humble enough to have things pointed out to him. We need to come to that same place. Recognize that, tough as it might be, we are not necessarily God's gift to whatever it is we are doing. But we are God's representative. And God can and will use us. Let's bow for a word of prayer this morning.